other headlines, Iran warns that holding a special session of the UN Human Rights Council on Iran will negatively affect the country's cooperation with the West. Russia says it has completed the withdrawal of troops from the western bank of the Dnipro River in Ukraine's southern Kherson region. And the European Union warns the Eurozone is expected to fall into recession this winter as soaring energy prices take their toll on the continent. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister has slammed double standards of some Western governments rejecting their attempt to organize a special session of the UN Human Rights Council on Iran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a phone call with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He said that the Geneva-based council session must be held on the government's promoting violence and terror and not on Iran, that is a true defender of human rights. The top diplomat also warned about the negative effects of a political move by the UN rights body on Iran's relations with the West. Guterres, for his part, rejected the Council's meddling in internal affairs of other countries. A federal judge in the U.S. state of Texas has ruled that President Joe Biden's loan forgiveness program for students is unlawful and must be vacated. U.S. District Judge Mark Pittman called the plan an unconstitutional exercise of the Congress's legislative power. He issued the order after a conservative advocacy group filed a motion on behalf of two borrowers. The Justice Department has moved to appeal the ruling. The White House said it strongly disagrees with the court decision. President Joe Biden announced his plan in August. It called for forgiving up to $10,000 in student loan debt for borrowers making less than $125,000 a year. But the plan received backlash, with a group of six Republican-led states seeking to block it from taking effect. They have said that the scheme is costly, as it would eliminate over $400 billion of outstanding student debt. Control of the U.S. Congress hangs in the balance as vote counting still continues after Tuesday's midterm elections. The fate of the Senate has now come down to the election results of three states. Either party, the Republican or Democrat, can win a majority in the chamber by winning races in Arizona and Nevada. And that is because counting late-arriving ballots is expected to last several more days in those states. If that's a toss-up, Senate control will be decided in a runoff election in Georgia on December 6th. As for the House of Representatives, Republicans need seven seats to win the 218, that is, seats needed to control the chamber. Even a slim House majority would allow Republicans to block President Joe Biden's priorities.
Another nationwide election in the United States, and it will be another drawn-out, bitterly fought, and highly divisive process to determine the final outcome for Congress. Starting with the certainties, the last-minute predictions of a Republican red wave did not materialize. They did, however, take control of at least the House of Representatives, but likely with a much smaller majority than many expected. That means America will have a divided federal government, that President Joe Biden's policymaking will be hobbled for his final 2 years, and that the Democratic Party did suffer a significant national-level defeat.
Hasn't anyone had an education? I'm appalled. We had to take the constitutional test. It is so mean-spirited. Our kids are suffering. I have a 24-year-old. They do not like this country. They do not like what's going on, and their lives are hard. This is the American dream. Now they want to take away Medicare.
In a repeat of 2020, the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote in the state of Georgia to be held on December 6th. That means Americans will have to endure nearly a month of uncertainty.
It's stupid that we would have that, need to take that much time, but part of it's because of a structure of how our, you know, we used to have this done really, you know, just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We had it done in 2 days, at worst case scenario, you know. But in the last three national elections, it's suddenly become an issue of, you know, we've got all this, you know, false voting, fake voting, blah, blah, blah.
Near universal worries about politically related violence didn't happen on election day, but it increasingly seems to be more accurate to call it election month. Adding to the growing tension is that controversial ex-president Donald Trump is expected to announce on November 15th that he's running for the presidency again. America may soon be arguing over the 2024 election before the 2022 election has been completely decided. To the chagrin of Democrats and many Republicans, at least 74% of over 250 Trump-backed candidates were victorious, and so-called 2020 election deniers won repeatedly at top state and federal levels. It appears that the factional split within the Republican Party is more cemented than ever, but the unexpected closeness of the congressional vote reveals that the overall split between America's left and right is more narrow, contested, and sharper than ever. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now the latest developments from the war in Ukraine. Russia says that it has completed the withdrawal of troops from the entire pocket it held in the West Bank of the Dnipro River, including the city of Kherson, southern Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry says all the troops and their equipment have been transferred to the eastern bank of the Dnipro River. The ministry issued the pullout order on Wednesday. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said that the withdrawal will not change the status of the Kherson region. That is one of the four areas that Russia annexed in September following a referendum vote. Ukraine, however, has been skeptical about the Russian pullout. Kiev says it would make Moscow at least a week to completely withdraw its forces. In recent weeks, Ukraine has launched counteroffensives to take back the area that it has lost. Professor of Political Science Glenn Deason explains why Russia has decided to withdraw its forces from Kherson.
It has its advantages and its disadvantages. The disadvantage is obviously that they lose a key city which Russia has recognized as its own territory. So withdrawing effectively from its own territory is obviously seen as a weakness. And also this forestalls any possible conquering of Nikolaev and Odessa to the west, which many had expected. But it could also argue to be a sound decision because the main problem was in this area, the Russians were not sitting in a very good position. Again, this is a war of attrition. They're trying to weaken each other. So Russia is always trying to find positions where its own troops are protected while it can inflict more damage on the Ukrainian troops. When Russia withdraws, it's usually because the Ukrainians go into a rain of artillery fire, and by the time they reach the Russian troops, they pull back. So they have previously given up territory to improve the manpower, so preserving their soldiers and military equipment while the Ukrainians are losing theirs.
The Eurozone economy is expected to slip into recession this winter as consumers face pressure of rising energy prices. That, according to the European Commission. The EU's executive arm says that the economic downturn will affect most of the bloc's member states in the last 3 months of 2022. The European Commission says the Eurozone economy will continue to become smaller in size until spring. The contraction of economic activity is battering the UK as well. Britain's economy shrank by 2 basis points between July and September. The contraction adds to the fears that the country's economy is teetering on the brink of a long-term recession. The UK's cost of living crisis, due large in part by the energy price hikes, is pushing more people to poverty. Syed Purizza travelled to a deprived region of London to find out how the soaring prices are impacting the vulnerable people.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, is I'm earning about a weekly 1,000. For example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary. They don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high. Gas high. And because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it, and he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities to get by. We were told the Rukhsana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits, and the government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Syed Purizza, Walthamstow, East London.
China eases its COVID restrictions, including a shortening of quarantine times for close contact of cases as well as inbound travelers. Under the new rules, those quarantine times will be cut by 2 days. Inbound travelers will also need to do a pre-departure COVID test only once in 48 hours and not twice. In the meantime, China has abolished the suspension of international flight routes due to detection of infected passengers. Also, it scrapped a penalty on airlines that bring in infected passengers. China adopted a zero COVID policy, which was largely proved to be successful to contain the disease. The strict measures, however, caused discontent. The government says there is a need to minimize the impact of those measures on the economy. Following the announcement, the yuan jumped in afternoon Asian trade. Now, leaders from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, have kicked off their annual summit in Cambodia. This year's meeting is focused on the issue of Myanmar. The country has witnessed escalating violence and political gridlock amid a military coup last year. The junta rulers are facing criticism for their failure to implement a peace plan agreed upon last year. The plan includes ending hostilities, allowing access for a special envoy and aid. ASEAN has said that it is committed to the plan, but some members have been pushing for a stronger stance. Now, the Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, who opened the ASEAN summit, has called for vigilance and wisdom during the times of economic and geopolitical turmoil. We talked to our correspondent Frank Smith about whether the ASEAN summit will have any impact on Myanmar's political reshaping.
Well, I'm not sure there'd be options. One of the, you know, features of the ASEAN grouping is its kind of voluntary nature. It you know, espouses non-interference in other states' affairs. Its agreements are voluntary, and it reaches the agreements that it does have through consensus. So, you know, enforcing, for example, sanctions or some type of intervention in Myanmar is really out of the question for ASEAN. They are coming under more heat, especially from, for example, the United States, to pressure Myanmar more in terms of the human rights abuses that have been reported from there over the past particularly a few months following the coup d'etat that removed Aung San Suu Kyi from power last year and replaced her with a military dictatorship. So while those features of ASEAN, however, non-intervention, volunteer, nature of agreements and consensus represent a stumbling block. On the other side, when you do have, you know, everybody together, it's a much sort of stronger agreement. But again, coming to an agreement on, for example, as you mentioned, sanctioning Myanmar is something that most experts find really kind of unlikely at this point.
Scuffles in Peru's capital, Lima, have broken out where police has used tear gas to disperse supporters of President Pedro Castillo. The demonstrators gathered outside the National Congress building demanding its shut down, and that is because of attempts at the opposition-dominated chamber to remove the president from office. More than a year into the presidency, Castillo has faced several criminal investigations of alleged corruption, but it is impossible to prosecute him on criminal charges while he is in office. President Castillo has already survived two impeachment attempts. There have been rallies in Lima in recent days calling on him to step down. But Castillo denies any wrongdoing and has defied those calls. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. God chose the people best prepared for his most important mission. If you look amongst yourselves, you will see that one of you looks more determined in appearance, stronger in physique, and more healthy looking in complexion. His hand is stronger, his arms are more powerful, his chest is broader. You'd ask that guy to help you carry a heavy load. You'd choose him for this task, and he'd probably rush to help too. So, if he was chosen, if he could undertake this task, meaning if he wanted to do it, because he definitely could do it, if he decided that he would carry this load, then he would stand out from his peers. You would say, poor guy, no one else could do it, so we didn't ask them. Instead, we asked you. When Allah chose the nation of Islam or the Israelites, it was in this sense. At their own time, the Israelites and the Muslims were the most able people to bear the responsibility of the divine mission of leading and guiding mankind. This is why Allah entrusted them with this mission. Did they bear it faithfully or not? If they did, they would have carried this trust to its destination, and they would have been the best and most worthy of the Muslims. But if they didn't, then what? If they didn't, then they are in the same situation as the Israelites, who did not fulfill the trust that Allah placed in them. So they were struck with abasement and poverty, and they earned God's wrath. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 61. This is in this world, and their refuge is hell. This is in the hereafter.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He chose you to bear this responsibility and has not placed for you any obstacle in the religion. He has not created any difficulty or hardship in the religion for you. This responsibility is not excessively burdensome. Being chosen is not a punishment. You are capable of bearing this duty. The faith of your father, Ibrahim. This is the same faith as that of Ibrahim. He named you Muslims before and now. This refers to Ibrahim's supplication in Surah Baqarah, and from our progeny a nation submissive to you. The Quran, Surah 2, verse 128. So God is saying that He gave them this name before and also now. Why? For what reason? In order that you do what? So that the apostle may be a witness to you, and that you may be witnesses to mankind. So that the prophet will be responsible for you, and you will be responsible for mankind. So that the prophet watches over you and witnesses what you do, and so that you will watch over mankind and witness what they do.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Money changes everything. Money talks. Put your money where your mouth is. And nowhere are those proverbs more taken to heart than in U.S. elections, where billions of dollars are raised and spent. Big money is the name of the game in American politics today, and we're going to see just how this game is played.
Money drives vote.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Does money actually influence elections? Will billionaires have an outsized ability to control policy agenda? And does anyone see this as a threat to the future of representative democracy? Those are the questions we're trying to discuss in this episode. Now, as usual, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Christopher Halali, who ran for election to the U.S. Senate to represent the state of Vermont back in 2020, and Malik Abdul, a political commentator who is joining us out of Washington. Stay tuned.
How strong is the association between campaign spending and political success? For House seats, more than 90% of candidates who spend the most win. From 2000 through 2016, there was only one election cycle where that wasn't true, 2010. In that election, 86% of the top spenders won. So, in a nutshell, you can say there is a good chance that if you spend more money, you win.
Now, this year, the money has been coming in and out of political campaigns at a particularly furious pace. The total cost of the 2022 federal midterm elections is projected to reach almost a record $9.3 billion. Now, that's almost $2 billion more than the amount spent in 2018. So why are midterm elections becoming so dang costly?
I think fundamentally, the midterm elections are proving to be major battlegrounds for political power and influence in the American political system. And what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of effort and millions of dollars being spent in campaigns that before in states where you wouldn't have that kind of money. And it's really because the margins of power and control in both the House of Representatives and the Senate are so small that only flipping one or two or a handful of seats means the other party getting control of that body. So ultimately, what we are seeing is we're seeing a ton of money, special interests, lobbyists coming in and pouring into these campaigns in some races that nobody was really caring about just 4 or 8 years ago or 10 years ago.
So the amount of money flowing in from billionaires and huge lobbying groups to fund candidates running in the next midterm elections has also busted all previous records, $1.3 billion. Now, that is a very big number, and by the way, it is not under the table. That's how campaign financing works in America. So shouldn't this practice be illegal, since, of course, these candidates, when elected, will have to do something in return for this money, right?
A new study has found that the total cost of 2022 midterm elections is projected to reach almost $10 billion. I'm not opposed to billions of dollars being spent in political campaigns because there are some people who do better than others, but I think we do need to pay more attention to the dark money, because if we have, there may be some dark money group funding campaigns that have associations with people or organizations or places that don't work for the American people or working against the American people. So, okay, yes, fine with money in politics, even billions being spent in politics, but I do think that there needs to be more regulations, or I would be supportive of regulations around.
Political expenditures have changed dramatically over the past few elections. In 2000, outside spending on political campaigns was roughly $50 million. So what changed? Well, in January of 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case known as Citizens United, which basically allowed unlimited political spending by individuals and corporations. The way this works is that although the law sets a limit on contributions directly to a candidate, there is no limit to indirect candidate contributions.
Lobbyist groups and things like that can give money to campaigns, exorbitant amounts to campaigns, through other means available to them. And ultimately, this boils down to issues of, fundamentally in our system, that corporations and those kind of interests have personhood under the law. So they are able to contribute in that way. There are many calls to make that illegal. And ultimately, it is true that those candidates who take money, be it from pharmaceutical companies, military industrial complex like the weapons manufacturers, from prisons, especially private prisons, from various entities out there, be they oil, gas, whatever they might be, that they are ultimately beholden to those interests.
Although big spenders are not allowed to coordinate with the candidate directly, this rule is clearly and openly ineffective. The donated money is spent on things like events and staff salaries, but generally, about 75% of funds go toward direct advertising, like mail, radio, television, and internet ads. So, what about the candidates that get fewer funds? What are their odds of winning?
I think that you can more often than not say that those who spend more money get elected. However, there are many examples where that isn't the case. For example, during the Democratic primary, just the last election cycle, Michael Bloomberg spent hundreds of millions of dollars on his campaign, and he went really nowhere. It was eventually Joe Biden who went forward, who spent a fraction of the money that Mr. Bloomberg had put in. I think ultimately it's a combination of money, but also some of the issues and the zeitgeist of, the current times that really propel certain candidates and parties to elected office.
Now, individual donors contributing $200 or less account for a greater share of money raised by federal candidates in this year's midterm elections. Now, those small donors make up 21% of all funds raised by candidates and political committees. So what are the incentives for these small donors?
You know that candidates often tout the amount of money that they've seen from small donors. In fact, if you're trying to get some of those big dollar donations, then strategists and the campaign staff alike, they are going to tout the amount of money that you've gotten from small donors. The importance of that is that being able to say that you've had, you may have 50,000, and this is just a number, 50,000 small donors donating to your campaign, what that means at a practical level is that there's a certain amount of momentum that you have backing you.
The rise of small donors in itself can raise hope that this increasing group can act as a counterbalance against the powerful lobbyists and mega donors, but it is not that easy. Because to be a candidate that can attract a sizable small donation, you need a lot of media visibility in the first place, and that media visibility most of the times needs donors who could cover your finances for media shows and ads.
There are a lot of small donors who want to give the maximum amount to certain candidates that they find will carry their interests. And then there are those small donors who give small amounts because they might be working class or working poor, and they want to see an insurgent candidate win the primary or win their race. So ultimately, you have these two sides, be they the corporate candidate, someone like Joe Biden or the Michael Bloombergs like we talked about, or even the Donald Trumps. And then you have the insurgent candidates, someone like Bernie Sanders, who comes in and has a lot of contributions from smaller donations made by working class people to achieve, an insurgent candidacy to change fundamental policies and the structure of how things are done in the United States. More often, of course, in history, the moneyed interests and those donations that come from the big dollar donors are the ones that get ahead. But Bernie Sanders' campaign showed historically that there is an opening. And also the same is true on Donald Trump's side, who got a lot of money, not only from major donations, but from a lot of working class people because of some key issues that he spoke about. So we're seeing a rise of populism here. And I think that that's evident in the donations that the candidates are getting.
In the United States, campaign season begins long before elections. These longer campaign seasons necessitate major fundraising just to keep them alive. Now, it seems as if for House lawmakers and the short two-year term that they have, the top concern is to raise money in the first year and spend it the second year. Do you agree?
Yes. With those two-year election cycles, it does mean that lawmakers are, as soon as they raise the money, they spend the next year trying to spend the money in anticipation of the next campaign. Because if you think about it, 2 years, you only have 2 years. So if you're running every 2 years, You run your campaign, you get in office that first year, try to get some things done. But by the second year, you're already into your second campaign season of sorts. So that next year, you're running another campaign. And so you need more donors. You need a whole campaign apparatus. And you have to do this over and over and over again every 2 years.
Few things in life are more predictable than the chances of an incumbent member of the U.S. House of Representatives winning re-election. The incumbent's re-election rate in Congress is well over 90%, sometimes even as close as 98 or 99. So walk us through the big picture. Why spend so much money to send pretty much the same group of people to the Congress?
Why? Well, there's one thing. There's something to the idea that people like. People vote for those whom they like. In some cases, they vote for those whom they like less. We have people in office because consider a person who's been in office for 15 years or 20 years or something. Why do you keep electing them into office? Well, some of these, well, many of them, the idea is that if you get in office, especially at the congressional, at the federal level, if you get in office, then there are things that you're able to do for your community. So if you are in, for instance, a college town or a manufacturing town or an agricultural town, you may pour money into the local college. You may be able to get money to fund a manufacturing plant, or you may be able to get money for farmers or things like that. Those are the things that politicians do, and we call them earmarks. So you're able to earmark a certain amount of money that goes towards your particular pet project.
A number of arguments have been put forward to explain the high rate of incumbency re-election or the so-called congressional stagnation. Candidates that are re-elected are said to be more experienced, that is to say, they have run a successful campaign before. They have also had media coverage, which gives them name recognition, but if you look at these factors closely, all of them come down to one thing: money.
Especially outside the United States, to understand, the Democratic and the Republican parties are two sides of the same coin. Both are ruling class parties, capitalist parties, that ultimately perpetuate their own power and interests. That they both spend so much money and criticize themselves in public means only that they play golf together and smoke cigars in their back rooms in private. Both of them profit tremendously off of this system. They spend hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on election cycles, but reap in tens of billions of dollars in the various gifts, donations, and power that they achieve through that. So they're able to give tax breaks to the rich. They're able to change restrictions on certain provisions, be they for environmental issues or for gas and fracking and things like that. They're able to give tremendous wealth back to the lobbyists and provide them with the legislation needed for them to increase their power and their wealth. So ultimately, what we see in the United States is that is a show. It's not really democracy. It's a show of a fake democracy that parades itself around as being the penultimate democratic country, when it's really a one-party state. And that party is, of course, the corporate party.
Now, Congress is the least most popular branch of government, with approvals in recent years sharply lower, generally in the 10 to 20% range. So if Congress is so unpopular, then why do we have so many small donors and also such a high percentage of re-election rates?
I think here it's important to understand and separate Congresspersons, representatives and senators, from the actual institution of the Congress or the Senate and House of Representatives that comprise the Congress. A lot of people are very committed to individual congresspersons who are of their political ideology, who uphold the banner of many of the causes that they believe in, whereas most Americans think that the institution is broken and doesn't enact the will of the people.
It's a common refrain that Americans may not like what Congress overall is doing, but they like the job their own member of Congress is doing. Indeed, it's true that approval for individual congressmen is almost always significantly higher than it is for either the House or Senate.
I think it's important to understand that there are many people who are committed to their political side. For example, those on the Democratic side with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and those on the Republican side, for example, with someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then you have the similar phenomena with the Supreme Court, which I think is important. That is why you still have so many people spending so much money and being so passionate about individuals, but the institution as a whole is has very poor approval overall, just like the Supreme Court and other institutions of the U.S. government, where key individuals are beloved by some on that political side, but the institution as a whole is not.
Now, the list of the top 10 mega donors shows that they have spent an unbelievable sum of $500 million. Now, these people actually go freelancing on their own, deciding which candidates they want to see in the Senate or the House. Moreover, only about 32,000 people, or just 1% of 1% of the U.S. population, contributes $1 billion, or nearly 30% of the money to the campaign. So what could be done to stop this cycle of money drives a vote?
I think ultimately the number one priority to have clean elections in the United States is to bar all corporate donations and all lobbying, really, from the political cycle. Political elections are for the representatives of the people, not for the representatives of the corporations, of big business, of the monopolies, and so on. So ultimately, if we are to have really democratic elections, first it requires that all of these corporations and lobbying groups are out of the political life in their totality. So unless that happens, unless there is some way, some mechanism, some law that can be passed and enacted where corporations are not allowed to give this amount of money and are not allowed to partake in the political process and political life of this country, you will never have clean elections. You will never have politicians who are really dedicated to the people.
I think that what can be done is we can do more things to place some regulations around the dark money in politics, because I do believe that we should know, with political campaigns, I believe that we should know where the money is coming from. So that's an important point. What will ultimately be done about it? I don't think a whole lot, because politicians on both sides, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, they all benefit from big money.
When 1% of 1% of the population provides almost 30% of the money in elections, you can bet that this amount of money pulls lawmakers away from the will of the majority and into the narrow interests of their donors, friends, and billionaires.
Money, it doesn't always equal victory, but it usually does. The steep price of a seat means that when elected, representatives soon learn that if they want to retain their seats, they have to cater to the 1% of the 1% group. So what is left out in the process are ordinary Americans who are becoming more disgruntled at an institution that is supposed to be the symbol of democracy and representation in the United States. And now it's time to see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us this week.
Elections in America never truly represent the will of the people. And that's because elections are never free nor fair, as billions upon billions of dollars are spent on elections every election cycle, and candidates are essentially bought and paid for by corporations, making it nearly impossible for a candidate truly guided by egalitarian and communalistic values to ever get elected. And if elections never truly represent the will of the people, that means that politicians don't represent the people either. On this segment of Power to the People, WE is going to take a look at the election spending and how money is in politics in America and how it supports American corporate domination. If we look at the recent 2020 election cycle, a record-breaking $14.4 billion was spent. And while all that money was spent on corporations and political interest groups getting politicians elected, the people in America, they didn't get no free healthcare or no free college, and there's over 500,000 people sleeping on the streets. And you know, America, it claims to be a democracy, yet Americans, they don't even get to choose or even vote on how there's a mass amount of money spent on sponsoring politicians' campaigns. Corporations spend billions upon billions of dollars getting their candidates elected so that they can have corporate influence and control over politics that allow their companies to exploit the people and rake in mass profits. This keeps the capitalist order running, as well as transnational corporate companies in control globally. And it doesn't just stop with elections. As big corporations, they continue to buy politicians once they are elected, as these corporations will do everything and anything to keep their control. An example of this is the pharmaceutical industry, where over two-thirds of Congress cashed a pharmaceutical campaign check in 2020. So now Big Pharma effectively has control over Congress, and they're able to pass laws that are favorable to pharmaceutical companies. Aside from politicians taking big checks from these pharmaceutical companies, these politicians, they also make big money on the stock market. Politicians, they are literally privy to certain financial information before things happen, allowing them to get away with insider trading while also being able to use their job as plausible deniability. The Pelosi's, for example, an official and a high-ranking politician. So of course she would know about the shutdown that's about to happen and the big spending that was going to be put into the pharmaceutical industry. And the Pelosi's themselves, they aren't the only ones that are doing this and getting rich. A recent New York Times investigation found that at least 97 current members of Congress bought or sold stock, bonds, or other financial assets that aligned with their work as so-called politicians. So it's very clear that big corporations fund their politicians to get elected, and fund politicians while they are elected to maintain corporate control over the United States government, or rather, the United Corporations of America. And we have to take big money out of politics, but that requires ending capitalism and freeing the land from Euro-American colonial control, which values profit over anything and everything. This is Power to the People. I'm Abbasi Mutakim.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
The light of Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, said, "The one who dies and does not recognize the Imam of his time will actually die the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to provide you with the most information regarding the Imam of your time. Yes, this is The Last Savior. And today we're going to discuss the signs of the advent of Imam al-Zaman, Ajallah Ta'ala Faraja. And on that note, today in our studio, we have with us very special guest. We have Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, Dr. Karim, in our previous episode, we discussed about the definite signs as per narrations, and one of the definite signs was Yamani, and we were discussing in our episodes that is Yamani actually a definite sign or not? We analyzed the narrations. We found some of them had a weak chain of narrations, and we found that some had scholarly debate. Because some of the narrations, a particular narration was having the word mathuma, that means definite, and the one that was not having the word mathuma in it was preferred over the previous one. So what do we conclude?
As you rightly mentioned, there are two narrations which explicitly refer to Yamani as one of the definite signs. But the problem with the first narration is that there are two versions of it. And according to one version, al-Yamani min al-Mahtum is not mentioned, and the other problem is regarding the chain of the narration. The second narration, which is quoted by Sheikh al-Saduq in Kamaluddin, page 650, reads, "There are five definite signs before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, خمس علامات محتومات, and one of them is Yamani."
Okay.
But the problem with this narration, as I explained in the previous session, is that there is another version of this narration in Al-Kafi and in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, according to which the word Mahtumat is missing. So the narration reads, there are five signs before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. So which one should be preferred? We said that the narration in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani is not an authentic narration, but the narration in Al-Kafi and in Kamaluddin, both of them are authentic. So which one should be preferred?
All right.
A group of scholars believe that the narration in Al-Kafi, which is without mahtumat, should be preferred.
Okay.
Which means that Yamani is not one of the definite signs. Why it should be preferred? The first reason is that the chain of the narration in Al-Kafi is more authentic than the chain of the narration in Kamaluddin.
All right.
We talked about that. The second argument for preferring the narration in Al-Kafi is a technical discussion in Usul al-Fiqh.
All right.
I try to put it as easy as possible so that because it is of benefit for other discussions when we have two narrations which may have some differences in the wordings.
All right. So let's discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old we
Welcome back. This is The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi with us, and we're discussing definite signs of reappearance, and we have focused on the sign Yamani, which is discussed as per many narrations as a definite sign, but we are debating over here, is that really a definite sign or not?
Imagine we have one narration mentioned in two ways.
Okay.
One of them, it has an addition, and the other does not have that addition. Like this narration, خمسة علامات محتومات, five definite signs, and the other is خمسة علامات, five signs. Which one should be preferred, the one with the addition or the one without the addition?
Yeah.
There is a discussion in Usul al-Fiqh, in the principles of jurisprudence. The famous viewpoint in that discussion is that the one with the addition should be preferred.
All right.
What is the reason? Because they say that it is likely for the narrator of the narration to forget one word, but it is unlikely for him, out of
negligence, not to mention one of the signs.
To add one word. No,
right.
To add one word. So imagine, it is possible for the narrator, the narration has been خمس علامات محتومات.
Okay.
So it is likely for the narrator to forget محتومات and just mention خمس علامات,
yeah,
five signs. But it is very unlikely to imagine that the narration has been خمس علامات and the narrator has added خمس علامات محتومات.
Yeah.
So for the possibility of forgetting one word is more than the possibility of adding one word to the narration of Imam of,
yeah,
the Imam alayhi salam. So according to this argument,
okay,
which narration should be preferred? The narration which reads خمس علامات محتومات,
which has the word.
Which has the word.
Okay.
Now, this is the viewpoint of the scholars who believe that Yamani is one of the definite
signs.
But then there is an even more complicated discussion here. And the point is that those scholars who believe that, no, Yamani is not one of the definite signs,
okay,
they say that, yes, we have this principle in Usul al-Fiqh, in, mm-hmm, the principles of jurisprudence, that the narration with addition should be preferred.
Okay.
But there is an exception here. And the exception is that we have some narrations in which one word has been repeated a lot.
Okay.
When it comes to the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, in many narrations, the word mahtum has been repeated. For example, in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 311, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "من الأمر محتوم ومنه ما ليس بمحتوم." There are some definite signs and there are some non-definite signs. ومن المحتوم خروج السفياني في رجب. One of the definite signs is the uprising of Sufyani or the riot of Sufyani in the month of Rajab. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, was asked whether Sufyani is one of the mahtumat. He said yes, and then he said, "One nida min al-mahtum."
There will be a cry from the sky.
Exactly. وطلوع الشمس من مغربها محتوم واختلافه بين العباس في الدولة محتوم وقتل النفس الزكية محتوم وخروج القائم من آل محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم محتوم. In Al-Ashad, volume 2, page 371. So my point is that when it comes to the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi عليه السلام, the word محتوم has been repeated a lot.
All right.
The companions of the Imams, they knew that there are two categories of the signs. Some of them are محتوم, definite, and some of them are not محتوم. They are not definite.
Okay.
There are many narrations in this regard. For example, your listeners can refer to Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 265, Kamaluddin, page 652, Hadith number 14. Now, the point is that although in Usul al-Fiqh it is mentioned that the narration with addition should be preferred.
Okay.
But when it comes to our case, because of the fact that in other narrations the word mahtumat has been repeated a lot, in this case it is also possible for the narrator to have made a mistake.
All right.
And just to add the word mahtumat because it has been mentioned in other narrations.
All right. Dr. Karimi will discuss more on that after a short break. Tell listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.